the Royal Australian Air Force in person, 1921 to 2021. Ad Astra Aviator. This is a series of podcasts recounting the personal stories of veterans and their families. The narrator is Gareth McRae, OAM.
Today we're chatting with Jack Lynch, MBE, former wing commander. Jack is a fighter pilot, helicopter gunship pilot, and aviation services business owner. A life of aviation with many, sometimes dangerous, but always exciting challenges, but also with a lot of job satisfaction. In the RAAF, Jack operationally flew Iroquois helicopters, 1 year in Vietnam, mainly on gunships, Sabre and Mirage jet fighters, RF4C Phantom jets as exchange instructor with the United States Air Force, and F-111C jets at RAAF base Amberley. In his business, he specialized in aerial photography, charter, commuter, and aviation consulting. He now lives in Brisbane, pursuing a career as a writer, aviation consultant, and pilot mentor. He is now in the process of qualifying as a remote pilot for commercial drone operations. For contributions to aviation, Jack was awarded an MBE and a Master Air Pilot Certificate by the Honourable Company of Air Pilots, London. Jack, it's good to talk to you. How are you today?
And good to talk to you too, Gareth, having heard about you.
I hope good things if you're relying on that information.
Certainly.
I've got to say, fighter pilot, gunship pilot, a helicopter gunship pilot, aviation services business owner, you've got a full career, Jack.
Well, I have, and I was very fortunate. I look upon it as being able to do my hobbies for my working life. And I achieved my boyhood dreams, and you can't really do better than that in life.
No, you certainly can't. I've got to ask, gunships or helicopters to fighters, if you had a preference, where would the preference lie?
Well, I would say fighters, because that was my dream, was to fly fighters when I was a kid. And in fact, I didn't have a happy childhood, and I'd already decided when I was early teens that I was going to depart the farm when I could. And one day I knew everything about sabres, because in the early 50s, when I was sort of becoming alert to the world around me, sabres, late 50s, the sabre was our mainline fighter, and that's what I wanted to fly. And what cemented it was one day I was riding my horse Peggy, moving a mob of 500 sheep, and two sabres flew over at low level what I now know is low level battle formation. And the sheep went everywhere. I didn't care. I was just riveted to these two beautiful jets, watched them as far as they could to the horizon, and actually said to my horse Peggy, I remember saying it out loud, "Peggy, one day that will be me." And that was a boyhood dream. And 13 years later, I was sitting in the cockpit of a Sabre to fly it.
I just got to ask you, just out off as a side, what did Peggy do? Did Peggy?
Oh no, Peggy was well trained. She was a great horse, and she just nodded when I told her that. She said, she said, "I'll miss you." But
all right. Now, you told me the background in terms of being obviously on the land, and sheep were involved there. What year did you actually join the RAAF?
I joined in 1966, October 1966. Having done what I had planned, was left home when I was 16. Went back to school. My old man wanted me to leave school so he'd have a lackey on the farm, and I didn't really want that. I wanted education. So yeah. We went back to school, and then I went to South Australia from Northeast Victoria, where I grew up in the Cali country, a little place called Winton, where the motor racing circuit is. And I went to South Australia from 62 to 66 on a cadetship, engineering cadetship, which was a part-time study and part-time work on the job, training. But when I reached 24 was the age limit for Air Force pilot application. So I just had to go, and I applied to the Air Force and was fortunate enough to get in.
Yeah. What was the transition then from the cadetship into actually flying, that first sitting in the Sabre, so you could say to Peggy, well, I got here. Oh. What was the transition?
Well, it was just marvellous. You know, I was well prepared mentally and had flown jets on training on the Vampire, trained on the Windshield Vampire, and then the choppers. Did a jet refresher on Mackies at East Sale upon return from Vietnam. And then in the Sabre, we did about 6 simulator rides. And then it was the real thing because there were no two-seat Sabres. And I think I almost cried because I just, it was just so hard to come to terms with, for a few minutes anyway. When I was walking out, with squadron leader John Williams, who was my chase pilot and instructor for that first flight. It was a very emotional thing for me. It wasn't a job or anything. It was this was my life, my boyhood dream coming true.
Yeah, that's great, Jack. Look, you joined in 1966, and so Vietnam has been underway now for 4 years.
Yes.
Starting in 62. What were the steps getting you to actually be based in Vietnam? Can you take us through that?
Yeah, well, pilot's course went from October 66, beginning on the Windshield at Point Cook, about 112 hours, and then to RAF Base Pierce in Western Australia, just north of Perth, on the Vampire, 100-odd hours on that. Graduated with wings, and because the Vietnam War was on, there was a high demand for helicopter pilots. So out of the 21 of us that graduated, I think 14 of us went to helicopters. And my instructor, I was older than the average age, or older than many of the fellows on my course. And, yep. And my instructor was a Navy pilot, Fred Lane, a wonderful bloke. He said, look, as an older bloke, don't worry about going to choppers. He knew I wanted to go to fighters. You go to choppers, you do well, and you may well get back onto fighters. So that was my dream. I went to choppers, threw myself into it, loved every second of it. Mm. So there was about a year of training, doing the conversion course at 5 Squadron in Canberra at RAF Base Fairbairn, and then doing exercises with the Army in preparation for them to go to Vietnam and for us to go to Vietnam. And then in March 69, I was posted to 9 Squadron Vietnam. And again, the right place at the right time, because as I arrived, within a month, they were aiming to have the gunships all built and the crews trained up and going into operations planned for the 20th of April 1969. So I started out as a co-pilot on Slicks, which are the normal Iroquois choppers. The only armour was a single M60 machine gun on each side, and seats inside for troop carrying, or on the floor for carrying cargo of various sorts, ammunition, food, whatever the Army needed. And fortunate, squadron leader Brian DeRue grabbed me and another fella by the name of Brian Brown, affectionately known as Bomber Brown, and we both ended up on gunships very early in our time in Vietnam, which to me was just absolutely marvellous, because I knew that there was a possibility that flying an armed helicopter would actually have some value of later on going to fighters. And so that's actually what happened. And interestingly, one of my heroes before I joined the Air Force was Bay Adams, a famous fighter pilot who flew Tempests and Typhoons in the Second World War. And he'd been mentioned a number of times in post-war books by Pierre Klosterman, who wrote Flames in the Sky and The Big Show. And he mentioned the tall Australian Bay Adams, who in the early 50s was now a hero of mine. It just so happened that towards the end of the term, and I was now a gunship flight leader and a flight leader overall of gunships and slicks, Bay Adams got myself and pilot officer Brian Brown, because he was on the base, he was the group captain, the air component commander, and he asked us, where do you blokes want to go when you leave night squadron? And in unison, we both said, of course, fighters.
Jets, yeah, fighters.
And Bay, he actually said, well, you realise the dickheads in Canberra, and that's the term he used, the dickheads in Canberra think if you've flown choppers, you can't think fast enough to fly a fighter. Now, Bay used to come and fly as a co-pilot on gunships, and he knew what we did. And he said it reminded him of the rhubarbs that he used to go on in Europe towards the end of the war on Typhoons and Tempests. Yeah. And he said, I'll advise you to write out a general application. Don't just leave it to the system to send you where they want. You write out a general application to go to fighters, and I will fight the good fight for you. I will back your application. I know your CO will back it. And we'll see if we can get you to fighters. So Brian Brown, Bomber, and I were the first two to successfully go to fighters. We did a refresher course on Mackies at East Sale before we went to Williamtown. And then at Williamtown, away we went onto the Sabre.
Yeah, let's just go back to the gunship for a moment, Jack. Firstly, just a couple of questions. How many crew were on a gunship?
Well, you had a captain and co-pilot. You had what was then called a crewman, who later became called loadmasters, and they supervised what went on in the back with troops or cargo or, yep, or whatever. And on the other side, we had airfield defence guards who flew with us as gunners, and they actually got their gunner's wing when they flew with 9 Squadron. And they each had twin M60s, and the pilots had rocket pods, a rocket pod each side that carried 7 2.75-inch folding fin rockets with 7 or 14-pound high-explosive heads, and twin fixed miniguns. A minigun is a six-barrel, like the old Gatling gun,
yep,
that could fire up to 6,000 rounds a minute, but ours were geared to fire at about 4,800 rounds a minute. Basically, that's about when they're firing, that's a bullet every 6 inches. It's quite an impressive machine.
So the gunners, were they Air Force personnel or Army personnel?
No, they were Air Force. The crewman was an integral part of the crew, and the gunners were created out of people that were taken from the airfield defence guards.
Okay, now the chopper itself, what was it like, and in terms of a battle component?
Well, the way it was, we built our own helicopter gunships that were slightly different from the American Army ones and the US Navy ones, in that we had the twin M60s on each side, whereas in the American equivalent, they had a bungee cord with an M16 as their weapon for the crewman and the gunner on the other side. With twin M60s, you had a greater firepower on each side. And the fixed miniguns meant that they were more reliable than the articulated ones that would fire basically wherever the aiming point was set by one of the crew, hydraulically operated. So the design was quite brilliant by my predecessors who designed it for twin miniguns, twin rocket pods, and the M60s on each side. And we flew basically as a pair, which was called a light fire team of two UH-1H gunships.
Yep.
And the idea of the actual design of weaponry was for the lead aircraft to fire from quite a way out with rockets to help mark the target, and also to have some heavy armament to keep the heads of the enemy down once the relative positions of friendlies and enemy were identified. And then you'd fire miniguns to get in closer, into sometimes a couple of hundred metres or even closer, and really heavy ones. And then the captain would, or whoever was flying, would roll the aircraft into a turn towards the friendlies and start a climb. But by the time, basically, the minigun had stopped and the pilot had ceased firing the miniguns, the M60s, which were mounted on a swivel with a cam that prevented the gunner from shooting the tail or the rotor, which would be a very exciting occurrence if that were to happen, they would actually begin firing. So there's basically no time that there wasn't ammunition falling on the bad guys. And because it was on a swivel, as the aircraft turned around and started to climb back up, the second aircraft would be coming in on its firing pass. And basically, as soon as the M60s of the door gunners had finished firing, that second aircraft was ready with his rockets and then his miniguns. So we were able to put firepower on the ground almost continuously as long as we had a supply of ammunition and fuel.
So therefore, as an effective fighting machine, the duality of two, it becomes a very effective piece of equipment.
Absolutely. And I think it was the best combination of the UH-1 variants of gunships. Of course, later on came the AH-1 Huey Cobra, which was a different aeroplane altogether. But we also flew in heavy operations with three gunships, which was called a heavy fire team. And because the size of our province was small enough that if we got into a heavy contact, we could get two gunships out there, the third one would be on standby, and then when one of the gunships was ready to leave and go and refuel, the third one would come in and then he would fill that slot, and then we could rotate one aircraft to go and refuel and rearm, but still have two on station. And there were operations where we needed to have that because our troops on the ground got into very, very heavy firefights at times. And I know that we saved a lot of lives by having the foresight of those who designed our Australian gunships and the training of ex-fighter pilots like Brian DeRue, who were our gunship flight commander.
Yeah. Because it's a helicopter and not a jet fighter, because the Australians didn't have jet fighters in Vietnam, only the Americans did, but because it's a helicopter, therefore it's flying lower and surely susceptible to ground fire, even rifle fire. Had you that kind of experience in your time?
Oh, certainly a lot of fire towards the aircraft. But again, in the gunship, that was part of the design, was to be able to keep firepower going onto the ground at all times. That's why we had twin everything, twin rocket pods, twin miniguns. You could actually select one at a time, and the crews in the back could select one weapon at a time, and it would give you a long time on station. And if you're an enemy on the ground and there's rounds falling around you, you don't really know if it's a twin machine gun or a single. All you know is it's rounds coming at you, so you're going to keep your head down. And while they've got their head down, they're not firing at our troops on the ground.
Sure. That experience in Vietnam in the gunships, what are your most memorable memories from your time there?
Well, there's a couple of really good instances that let you know the sort of operation that it was. I think it was 31st of July in 1969. I was a co-pilot on a gunship, and Charlie Company 5 Battalion got into a very heavy fight in a bunker complex of North Vietnamese and Viet Cong out to the southwest of Nui Dat, which was the Army Task Force headquarters. They had a number of troops that were wounded. They called us in because we sat on standby at Nui Dat, the gunships and the slicks. If we weren't actually doing a job, we were on standby. We were called out, and this is where we started out with a light fire team. And we went out first of all to help break the contact. And then we swung into three aircraft, a heavy fire team operation with three aircraft. And it was significant because we then had to cover the troops on the ground, plus two of our comrades from 9 Squadron in slicks who came in to rescue wounded troops that were still under fire. Flight Lieutenant John Hazelwood and Flight Lieutenant Lloyd Knight were the captains of the two dust-off. The rescue aircraft was called a dust-off, D-U-S-T-O-F-F. And the Americans said that it was an American term that meant dedicated, untiring support to our fighting forces, which was a good American acronym. Yeah. And of course, everyone adopted. Yeah. And when the troops got in contact and they needed someone pulled out, they'd call for dust off. So it went for some hours, 4 or 5 hours, this whole contact. The Army commander was Lieutenant Colonel Colin Khan, affectionately known by his troops as Genghis Khan, quite a great leader. And he was actually airborne in an Army Bell 47, and they had the call sign Possum. His call sign was Sunray. So he's airborne, he wanted to know what was going on. The troops on the ground, the one we were calling was the call sign 3-1. I was co-pilot to Flight Lieutenant Ted Creelman, a New Zealander, as Bush Ranger 7-1. I think Bomber Brown was co-pilot to Trevor Butler, another New Zealander. Both really great men, great pilots and great leaders. And I forget who was in the third aircraft now. But we liaised with the battalion commander. He helped organise getting the dust-off aircraft out there. And of course, they're also organising artillery to come in and support them. We had to keep clear of the artillery. And then the dust-offs came in one at a time. So we were putting fire on the ground when these fellas came in under fire. The fight is still going on. And I think John Hazelwood was first. They had to sit there in the hover, 100-odd feet above the treetops while the crewmen put down a litter to pull out the wounded troops. And of course that meant that he had to leave his gun, his weapons on his side, and they're only defended or self-defended on one side by the gunner on the opposite side to the crewman on the left-hand side, crewman on the right, gunner on the left, while the crewman put his trust in the gunships and the captain of his aircraft to look after him while he did that very vulnerable job of pulling the troops up, sitting there cool, calm and collected, and bringing this wounded digger up. And I can tell you the relationship between 9 Squadron and the Army was like cement. It was solid. It was absolute solid. And they were our brothers on the ground, and the job had to be done.
Yeah.
So they both dust off did that, And there is a tape. I took a tape recorder, the only flight I ever took a tape recorder, and there is a tape recording of the whole operation, recording all the gunfire on the ground, the radio call signs on the ground, our calls between each other in the air, our calls between us and our home base, and between us and the possum that had the battalion commander on board. And I'll send that to you sometime.
Yeah, Jack, thank you. These stories, it's so important that these stories are told, and people like you telling them gives a, that first-hand experience, which is just so important for someone listening to this right now who's not in any of the defence groups or hasn't been involved in any war situation, young, maybe Australians. It's such an important story. Vietnam especially has to be told and told and told again. How did you become an exchange instructor with USAF?
Well, after going on to fighters from helicopters, I went on to Mirages after the Sabre. I then went up to Butterworth for 2 years, came back with 75 Squadron, and then came back to Williamtown on 77 Squadron. Now, not many people know this because I didn't tell many people what my own plans were for my own career. But while I was in Butterworth, I knew that a course mate, a pilot's course mate of mine, Bruce Connell, was in America on exchange on the RF-4 Phantom, the reconnaissance version of the Phantom, and was absolutely loving it. And 77 Squadron, which I just happened to be posted back to, had a reconnaissance version of the Mirage with a reconnaissance camera mounted up the front. And I thought that would be a good thing for me if I went to America for a couple of years to replace my good mate Bruce Connell. So I also thought, now, there's a course down at Sale called the Officer's Photographic Course. I applied to do that before I left Butterworth, and I did that as soon as I got to Williamtown because I knew that having that course was a full officer's course, 3 months of solid learning about photography. It was equivalent to the civilian diploma of photography at TAFE. I knew if I had both that, and of course when I had that, when I went back to 77 Squadron, oh, you're photographic qualified, so we'll make you one of our reconnaissance pilots. And then sometime later on, when they were looking for someone to replace Bruce Connell, they found
it.
I filled the slot.
Yeah, funny about it.
And my mates were saying, "You bastard, Lynch, how did you get that job? I wanted that." I remember a dear departed mate, Jimmy Rothel, and he was really angry when he found it because he had jibbed at me. And he said, "Why are you going to," earlier on, he said, "Why are you going to do a bloody photographic course with no flying?" "Oh, don't worry about it, Jim." And then it all dawned on him that that was all part of the plan.
So let's just go back to while you are an exchange instructor with USAF.
Yes.
How good was that?
Well, it was marvellous because it was an instructional job. They have a different system over there. To be an instructor in the RAAF, you have to go to instructor school, central flying school. But over there, they had instructors on each type of aircraft. So I did an instructional course on the Phantom. I did a conversion onto the Phantom for about 4 months on a regular conversion course, and then I did a 3 month instructor's course, and then I was placed in the 33rd Tactical Reconnaissance Training Squadron as an instructor, and we were teaching young guys who'd come from the USAF Academy and young pilots who'd come off the direct entry pilot training courses, and people who'd flown KC-135s, B-52s, and other sorts of aircraft who were transitioning onto the RF-4.
And how receptive were the American students to an Australian instructor?
Oh, extremely well. There'd been quite a long line of instructors. I think the first one that I can remember was Lyle Claffer. He was a squadron leader, and then two more squadron leaders, and then flight lieutenant Bruce Connell off my pilot's course, and then I was a flight lieutenant. So they knew Australians well. We knew their language very well, because language could be a problem at times. And having worked with Americans in Vietnam, and we all had very great mutual respect for each other. And it was also very helpful when they realised that I had also flown in Vietnam and worked with Americans. They loved that, because they loved the fact that Australians have been beside the Americans in all wars since World War One.
That's right. In fact, it was the only Australian to command a fully American group was Monash.
That's right, yes.
The Battle of Hamel, yes.
Yes, yes. Well, people in the US Army still talk about General Monash. But I mentioned before about language. And, of course, students would come from all over America. And at that time, we also had students from Iran when the Shah was in charge. And we had German students as well. There was also a Canadian exchange officer on the base, and a British exchange officer, and a German exchange officer. We all became very good mates and had a lot of fun, especially in the officers' mess on Friday nights.
Oh, here we go.
But I had a student from Alabama once, a really sharp young guy. But I had to actually adopt an American accent and some Alabama lingo before he would really understand what I was trying to say about instructing him on the Phantom. And that was quite an experience. And I had to really fight not to develop a really deep American accent. And the other thing, the other interesting thing was the Iranians were all quite sharp fellows and hand-picked. Some of them had a very close relationship with the Shah himself. And one of these fellows flew with an American fella from Georgia who had that deep South accent. And this fella from Georgia came back one day and he said, "Oh, this is really sad. We're going to have to suspend this fellow off the course. He doesn't do what I tell him." And the Canadian and myself knew what the problem was, and we'd followed it through a little bit, and it was because the student could not understand the fellow from Georgia. So that was a very ticklish situation for us to break to the commanding officer. And the Canadian and I flew with this fellow and did things like air-to-air refueling, night work, and he'd flown F-14s, and he was a really, really sharp fellow.
Yeah, he knew what he was doing.
And it was a language thing. But the commanding officer didn't say anything. He just made sure that the word was out that the students were not to fly with anybody from the southern states.
Isn't it great that we live in a country that all speaks Australian?
Yes, right.
Right, yeah. Across the whole continent.
Yeah.
I want to focus for a moment, if you don't mind, on your MBE, because that's a rather prestigious award to have received. And it was, I believe, for work that you did for project work and also being a test pilot on reconnaissance F-111s.
Yeah. First of all, I hasten to add that I'm not a qualified test pilot like the pilots from the RAF's Aeronautical Research and Development Unit. I was what was called a production test pilot after I left the Air Force. But for this particular job, it was a conversion of a prototype one of our F-111s to a prototype reconnaissance F-111, and I was already flying F-111s, and because I had the reconnaissance experience in America with all of the systems that went on board our version of the F-111, again, I was very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time with relatively current experience on those systems to go and be the development pilot for that. The first flight was done by a fully qualified test pilot, because you had to take the aircraft through its full envelope. That was done by Flight Lieutenant Terry Farquharson, who was an Empire Test pilot graduate. But I went over there as a squadron leader with a Flight Lieutenant Navigator and a Flight Lieutenant Backup Pilot, Martin Chalk, the Navigator, and Frank Atkins, my pilot. I shared the flying around. He was there as a backup, but we shared the flying around quite well, so that everyone was able to develop knowledge that we could apply when we got back. But there was a lot of work that I did, that writing manuals and things like that, reviewing the flight test program. Unfortunately, because I had the experience that I did have, I was able to rewrite the flight test program and save about 2 months off the original planned flight test program, and that saved the RAF about $8 million. We had a hand-picked team of engineers, technical people for instruments, radio, radar, airframes, engines, and so on. The very best people in the world. And it wasn't me that got myself the MBE. It was just a total team effort. And it is a bit embarrassing to be the only one to get an MBE. And whilst I accept the honour, and you know, and I'm very pleased that I got it, I do wear it, and I don't mean this to be trite, but I do wear it for every single person that was on that team. They were so good to work with.
Yeah, Jack, everyone who is given a special honour by the Australian government or the British government or whatever, yes, they get the honour, and yes, of course, it goes without saying that you are part of a team. Mm. There's no I when you spell the word team.
Yeah.
But someone is awarded it as a representative of all those other people that work with it. So wear it with pride.
Yeah, and the team we had, I ran it a little different to what probably was the Air Force normal. When we would have a meeting of the whole team together, we'd drop ranks. It would be first name basis, and the most junior man, who was a leading aircraft, and he was an airframe fitter, and to be a leading aircraft craftsman, Dave Kedsley, and to be picked to go on a project like that is indicative of how professional he was in his work. And every one of those men, be LAC, corporals, sergeants, flight sergeants, warrant officers, and of course the squadron leader and flight lieutenant engineers, were the best in their field. And it was a real honour to work with them.
Yeah. Jack, in 2015, the Master Air Pilot Certificate, how important is that for you?
Well, again, as a personal thing.
I know, it's a team.
Yeah, well, that's a recognition of contribution to aviation overall. It's awarded by what used to be called the Guild of Air Pilots and Navigators, now called the Honourable Company of Air Pilots. And it comes, it's patron was Prince Philip, the Grand Master, the Prince Andrew at the time when I got my award.
And it is a very prestigious worldwide
award.
That particular certificate, Master Pilot's certificate,
is awarded for your overall contribution and contributions.
And I think having flown choppers, fighters, reconnaissance, and done those sorts of things, and been flight commander, and executive officer, and then had my own flying after the air force, put me in line for that, and it was quite a surprise, quite a friend of mine had dobbed me in, and he was part of the organisation in Ian Fogarty, and I went to London in 2017.
Had some bang up nosh in the black tie in Guild Hall, which was absolutely magnificent, an 800 year old hall.
where King Henry VIII
had given the order to
have Anne Boleyn's head chopped off.
That's part of history as well.
I'm glad you came back with your head.
Yeah, me too. Yes.
Tell me about your involvement. Tell me about your involvement with the Great Darling Down Zero Club.
When I set up my own aviation business in the Air Force after working in Sydney for a few years. I was a member of the Darling Down Zero Club,
and I thought it would be good to teach private pilots how Air Force did low level navigation.
And I came up with a low level navigation route. They had to hack a clock at a check out point, fly low level to 1,500 to 1,000 feet at whatever speed they planned their aircraft, at a turn point within plus or minus five seconds. And along the way, they had to ask questions about how many silos were at the farm, along the route. What was the colour of the farmhouse, and various questions like that to gain points, which went for about 20 minutes.
Which was quite a high workload.
Fighter pilots, and any other Air Force aircraft that needs flight level, flight level, and sick to retirement. It was very successful. I left most of the paperwork there, but I'm not sure whether they run it anymore. When we did run it, it was very popular.
Of all the planes you've flown, including helicopters, what's your favourite and why?
Well, that's a no-brainer for me. That's the Sabre. That was my dream aircraft as a kid. I had all the magazines, everything that was possibly known, was not classified about the Sabre. It was my boyhood dream to fly the Sabre.
And also, it was a single seat aircraft.
You were fully responsible.
Had a big bubble canopy where you could see around 360 degrees.
And as a fighter pilot, that was bread and butter for getting shot down.
And it was just a beautiful aircraft.
And there's only one flying in Australia, by ex-Air Force pilot Jeff Trapp, who has one down in Victoria. Does airshows around the Air Force has one, but it's flying, but it doesn't have the right ejection seat in it, and it seems to me that it would be the will part of the hierarchy to get this thing flying. Otherwise we'd have this beautiful fully refurbished aircraft flying around Air Shows, which I think would be a great thing for Air Force publicity.
Good answer, and I think Peggy will be proud of the decision you made when those two sabres flew over you and scattered the sheep. You go and fly them. She certainly would. And I will give Ringo a copy of the poem. Exactly that. Absolutely honoured to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much. Wonderful story, wonderful history, wonderful history. And you are part of a very wonderful history. 100 years of the Royal Australian Air Force. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Thanks very much, Gareth. Thanks very much, Gareth.
Globally, the RAAF has between 500 and 700 people on operation every day. Contributing to coalition operations, peacekeeping, and humanitarian disaster relief. The RAAF takes pride in its service. It has a history of endeavour and sacrifice, which is one in a place in the hearts of all Australians, and a position of respect among the armed services of all Australia's allies. The
RAAF will never tarnish its record.
It carries on.
In the proud tradition of Per Adua Astra.
This is a series of recounting the personal stories of veterans and their families. Produced by Air Force Association New South Wales, which is a registered charity that focuses on the well-being of Air Force veterans and their families. If you would like to donate with this important cause, you can search Air Force Association New South Wales and go to our website.